At this time, we'll ask Mr. John Mulholland to come forward and speak to us on the topic, Daniel, Prophet for the Future.
Good evening to all. Daniel chapter 2, verse 21 says it quite clearly what this is all about. God changes the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Then in verse 28, the God in heaven reveals secrets and makes known to the king what shall be in the latter days. In verse 29, reveals to the king what should come to pass hereafter, or as we heard in the version read from, what comes to pass in the future. Daniel, truly a prophet for the future. The book of Daniel, more than most books of the Bible, has received a great deal of criticism and analysis. Its authenticity has been challenged for two millennia. It began, as far as we know, by the Neoplatonist philosopher Porphyry. He was a Greek non-Christian philosopher of the 3rd century AD, who viewed Daniel as being written about the middle of the second century. And his essential argument was, no person can foretell the future as described in this book. In the 17th century, with the rise of the deistic movement, its dating was, again, assigned to the period 170-165 BC, and it was considered as a collection of Maccabean writings of history and fables of Jewish origin. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the mid-20th century included several scrolls of the Book of Daniel, which scholars have dated between 175 and 200 BC. And these scrolls, being copies of earlier scrolls, require its authorship to be a century or two earlier. The Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Scriptures has been fairly well shown to have occurred between 200 and 300 BC. And since the book of Daniel is one of the books translated into Greek, it requires its authorship to precede that time. And, of course, there is the Jewish canon, which was well established around 300 BC, which means Daniel is probably, at the earliest, a 4th century BC writing. Of course, we have that certain portions of the book are written in the first person by Daniel and by one king, Nebuchadnezzar. And that would indicate that this must be a 6th century writing. And we do know that Jesus quotes Daniel, giving credence to it as being a believable and must be believed Christian writing. Then, of course, there is a contemporary book, Ezekiel, who mentions Daniel as a righteous man, the equal of Noah and Job. And he describes Daniel as a revealer of secrets. So Ezekiel corroborates the existence of a man in his time. And scholars, noting the dating system used in the book of Ezekiel, that is one that was used in the 6th century BC, they have ascribed a 6th century BC authorship to the book of Ezekiel. So if they ascribe that to Ezekiel, why not to Daniel, his contemporary? The book of Daniel naturally divides itself into 10 parts. 10 easily remembered stories, some of which contain major prophetic visions, and all of which teach a summary lesson in their story. The first 6 involve kings, world leaders, but they have only one major prophetic vision, the prophetic vision upon which and around which the entire book of Daniel is built. The last 4 stories tell of prophetic visions given to Daniel and the understanding of them by an angel of God. And these provide further details of the first vision which Nebuchadnezzar dreamt. Thus, we can visualize a demarcation line between what is revealed to kings and what is revealed to Daniel. Our intent will be to treat this very much like a school time look at a book report. We'll follow the course of presentation in the book, story by story, by way of a very brief description of the stories, a mention of its major prophetic vision, if any, and the summary lesson from each of those stories. And hopefully this will engender in our minds a simple picture book of the book of Daniel upon which we may reflect whether or not we will believe what it says is true or reject it. Chapter 1 is a time period roughly 604 BC to 601 BC. It's the time when Israel was first defeated by Nebuchadnezzar and made a vassal state of the Babylonian Empire. It is a story of Daniel and his 3 friends receiving the king's education of all that man can provide as knowledge and wisdom. And we find that in the course of the story, they trust in the God of heaven, which causes them to separate themselves from the other captives and refusing the king's food provisions. It concludes with their being presented to the king and found to be 10 times wiser in all matters of wisdom and understanding than all of Babylon's intellectual elite. So we have a very simple lesson being taught in this story, that God's knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, which he speaks and gives, is 10 times better than the very best than all a man can muster in all the periods of time that man has been upon the earth. And it's so stated in verse 17, God gave Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And in addition to this, God also gave Daniel understanding in all visions and dreams. This is the prologue story, establishing the purpose of the book of Daniel to be the revelation of God's visions and dreams through Daniel that are beyond the capabilities of man to in any way accurately foretell the history of mankind. Chapter 2, the second story, immediately introduces God's visions and dreams in the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, where he dreamt of a great image representing the world's nations, which is ultimately destroyed by a stone that subsequently rules the entire world. Immediately and dramatically, God, in a single, simple, easily remembered vision and dream, presents the timeline of the history of the world devolving from Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire. And what an image it is. It is top-heavy. It is supported on an unstable foundation. It consists of a gold head, silver arms and upper torso, a brass lower torso, iron legs, all supported on feet of chunks of iron mixed in among clay. No one in their right mind would build such an image. It cannot support itself. And that is just the point being made. The subsequent nations mankind devises from Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire will devolve into a mishmash of unstable, unsustainable nations that will ultimately crash down into nothing. It is a timeline of history from 605 BC through our present age to some time in the future. Historically, we know this is exactly how our modern nations have devolved. Beginning with the gold head representing the Babylonian Empire, followed by the silver arms and upper torso representing the Medo-Persian Empire, which in turn was followed by the brass lower torso representing the Grecian Empire, which devolved into the iron legs representing the Roman Empire, which divided itself in course of time into separate Eastern and Western empires, which again devolved into nations of the world we now have. We cannot dismiss the accuracy of the image describing the history of the world. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar is also taught a lesson. Daniel began his explanation to the king saying, "There is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king what shall be in the latter days." That is the crux of the vision and the dream. To teach man's rulers of nations, there is a God in heaven. It is that conclusion Nebuchadnezzar comes to. And he says, the truth is, Daniel's God in heaven is God of gods, Lord of kings, and revealer of secrets. Of course, we know only too well that acknowledging what is true does not mean an individual will accept truth as the basis of their belief and their guide as to how they will live their life. Chapter 3 is the story of Nebuchadnezzar's unbelief of the truth he had just learned. He builds a gigantic golden image to be worshipped by all the nations he has conquered and subjugated into his Babylonian empire. It is all gold from head to toe. The very metal representing Nebuchadnezzar and his empire. He cannot accept the truth. He believes his empire is invincible and eternal. No doubt he had God's image on his mind. No doubt he was greatly disturbed by what that image said to him and said about his empire. For it declared he would have no lasting dynasty. One thing kings, dictators, political leaders of all stripes, they all lust for one thing, to be eternally perpetuated in the annals of history as great men. Nebuchadnezzar is no different. And being an absolute sole ruler, he expresses that desire in his demand, his image, representing his empire, be worshipped by everyone as their God. As a sole ruler, he's asking them to worship him, to worship government as their God. Government worship has been the rule century after century. Government solves all woes. Government provides every need. Nothing else is necessary. Just put your trust in government, and we will take care of you. And we are seeing that again today in the present day financial crisis. But in the story, Daniel's three friends refused to worship the image, causing Nebuchadnezzar to have his servants throw them into a fiery furnace. The result, number one, Nebuchadnezzar's servants are burned up. They're ones who worship government. Number two, Daniel's three friends are unharmed because of a fourth person that appears in the fire, whom Nebuchadnezzar describes as having the form of the Son of God. The lesson taught by what he saw was not lost upon Nebuchadnezzar. And he proclaims to all people, nations, and languages that God saves those who trust in him, not in government. And acknowledges no other God can deliver like this. But again, the question, does Nebuchadnezzar really believe this? It is easy to recognize the lesson taught. It is easy to speak about it. But to actually believe it applies to our own self is an entirely different matter. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, begins the next story, the next stage of lessons to Nebuchadnezzar, to teach him to believe in the God of heaven. Here he writes his own story. Nebuchadnezzar, to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, I thought it good to show you the signs and wonders the high God has wrought toward me. It is a personal story of how power corrupts and absolute power absolutely corrupts the mind. And we see that even today. National leaders still fill their minds with self-glorification, and is very well expressed in verse 30. Is not this the great Babylon I have built for the house of my kingdom by the might of my hand and for the honor of my majesty? The lesson of the story unfolds as God first reduces Nebuchadnezzar to live like an animal in the wild, until a day God returns him to live like a man again. And again, the lesson is not lost upon Nebuchadnezzar, for he comments upon his experience couched in the phrase, "My reason returned to me." And indeed, his reason did return to him, for he had learned to praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, whose works are truth, his ways judgment, abasing those that walk in pride. Did Nebuchadnezzar learn it or just say it? Well, Daniel later, in chapter 5, comments on what Nebuchadnezzar had learned, telling Belshazzar, the king's grandson, that his grandfather learned, "The Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomsoever he will." That lesson is the essence of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that in the end, God will appoint one and only one to rule the world in its entirety. As an aside comment, if the story seems a bit far-fetched, there is a clay tablet in the British Museum. It's numbered BM34113. It describes Nebuchadnezzar's behavior during his insanity. And it reads, in part, "His life appeared of no value to him." Then he gives an entirely different order. He does not show love to son or daughter. Family and clan does not exist, or some of the phrases found in that tablet. So we should not discount the story or the lesson taught by it, saying it is a mere Jewish myth. Chapter 5 is another story, but to a different king. It is after Nebuchadnezzar is dead. His son has been murdered by his son-in-law, who had usurped the kingdom. And when his son-in-law died, the son-in-law's son was murdered, and Nabonidus usurped the throne. And he apparently married Nebuchadnezzar's widowed daughter and made her son, Belshazzar, co-regent with him. That is as far as historians and archaeologists have been able to piece it together. Also, Belshazzar's name appears on another Babylonian clay tablet discovered in the last century. So we know he is a real person who, in this story, hosts a great feast wherein he desecrates utensils meant to be used solely for the worship of the God of heaven. And to his amazement, a hand appears upon the wall. The upshot is, no one is able to interpret it. So Daniel is called to interpret the writing and tells the king, you lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven who gives you life. That is the crux of the Bible message. God gives us life, and therefore, God judges what we do with the life given to us. Belshazzar is judged, and he is told, God has numbered your kingdom. God has weighed you in the balances. And God has found you wanting. Your kingdom is given to another. And that night Belshazzar dies as the Medo-Persian Empire swallows up the Babylonian Empire. As Belshazzar was judged, so we will be judged on what we do with the life God has given us. Chapter 6 moves on to the new king, Darius the Mede. It is a story about a deceitful tactic of Daniel's enemies to have Daniel killed. The Medo-Persian kings had an unalterable law. No royal decree could be altered or set aside. Therefore, Darius was tricked into issuing an unalterable royal decree permitting no one to worship any god save the king for a set period of time. Daniel followed his daily custom. He openly worshiped God, and for this act, the king was forced by his royal decree to order Daniel to perish in a den of lions. The next day, when the lion's den was opened, Daniel was found alive and told the king, God sent his angel who shut the mouths of the lions. It is to this miraculous deliverance the king Darius issued an unalterable royal decree. All persons are to tremble and fear before God, for he is the living God, steadfast forever, whose kingdom and dominion is eternal, delivering and rescuing, working signs and wonders in heaven and earth. It is on that unalterable royal decree the stories of the kings, the lessons God teaches them, and the vision and the dream conclude. So we are at the break in the stories. The kings are behind us. And now it is Daniel who will have visions interpreted to himself by angels sent from God. There is therefore a very different emphasis in the latter half of the book. We might liken the book to be a series of stories forming a parable. The book of Daniel is not a parable, but its structure fulfills what Jesus taught concerning parables, as expressed in Matthew 13 and 11. Because it is given unto you, that is in our case, given unto Daniel, to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. But to them, that is to the kings, it is not given. The kings were only given one very simple, easily understood, easily remembered vision, which they did not believe was true. But Daniel will now be given much more to know the truth of that vision, because he believes it to be true, and God will reveal many more things to him to strengthen his belief in God. We also note that the latter half of the book is not in chronological order, like the first half. Chapter 7 is the first year of Belshazzar. Chapter 8 is the third year of Belshazzar. Chronologically, these two chapters precede chapter 5. Chapter 9 is the first year of Darius, and might chronologically precede chapter 6, or perhaps both are in Darius's first year. And finally, chapters 10 to 12 are later. They are the third year of Cyrus the Great, king of Persia. They are chronological amongst themselves, but not in the book as a whole. Thus, we would conclude the order of the stories in the book of Daniel are meant to emphasize what is being taught, what is being revealed. Just as the book of Judges has as its last five chapters speaking of events that occurred several hundred years earlier, because they were relative to the events immediately following in the books of Samuel and Kings. All did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king in the land. And suddenly, in the books of Samuel and Kings, we're introduced to the king in the land. So for the reader's benefit, the book is structured as it is. Daniel is going to be taught further lessons, lessons not taught the kings. And Daniel will have further prophetic visions given him, visions not revealed to the kings, visions providing more intimate details of Nebuchadnezzar's image that he dreamt. So these latter chapters are meant as lessons and revelations for those who trust in God's governance rather than for those who trust in man's governance. Chapter 7 is the story of Daniel's first personal vision, where he is shown four beasts representing the image Nebuchadnezzar dreamt of. And we know this is so because verse 23 tells us the fourth beast is the fourth kingdom, that is, the fourth beast represents the legs and feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And this beast is also said to devour the whole earth, treading it down, breaking it in pieces. We know from history this is true, for the Western Roman Empire devolved into the states of Europe, which colonized the Americas, Africa, and Asia, all of which devolved from tribal clans into the modern nations we have today, much due to the influence and actions of these states of Europe. And there are the states that came out of the Eastern Empire, known to us as the Byzantine Empire, which evolved into the modern Middle East and Slavic nations, who were then reorganized by these same European nations into the countries we now know. Daniel is shown a winged lion representing the Babylonian Empire. He's shown a bear representing the Medo-Persian Empire. He shone a four-winged leopard representing the Grecian Empire, which split into four empires before being swallowed up by the fourth beast, the Roman Empire. This story has a very specific purpose, because we read in it that Daniel takes a very special interest in the fourth beast. Why? Because it differs dramatically from the other three. It has 10 horns, of which 3 are taken out by their roots and are replaced by a single new horn. A new horn different from all the other horns. For this one has eyes and a mouth. It sees and it makes proclamations. Daniel describes its look as more stout than its fellows, inferring it looks stronger than the others. This horn exercises some form of power over the others, which they did not themselves possess. Obvious by the fact, the others are all without eyes and without a mouth. Daniel also informs us in verse 21 that this horn, with its eyes and mouth, made war with the saints of the God in heaven and prevailed against them. That is, until, verse 22, the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints, for it was time for the saints to possess the kingdom. Judgment involves the resurrection of the dead, which we all know is an event that has not yet occurred. So what Daniel has shown is something arising out of the original Roman Empire that, although not a king, somehow becomes a king ruling 3 kingdoms. And has some form of power making it greater than the remaining 7 kings and their kingdoms represented by the other 7 horns. History must be our guide. And history reveals that in the Roman Empire, under Constantine as its emperor, Christianity became the religion of the empire. And about 2 centuries later, the Western Roman Empire devolved into a series of kingdoms. And some centuries later, 3 of these kingdoms were given to the Roman bishopric. That is, they were given to the Holy See and became known as the Papal States. Today, the Holy See no longer has the Papal States, but rules over its remnant as its own sovereign national territory known to us as Vatican City, and is recognized as a nation among the nations of the world. It is complete with its own diplomatic corps of the Holy See, whose ambassadors are known to us as papal nuncios. And it has embassies in most nations of the world. Also, history tells us those opposing the authority of the Holy See as the only religion to be believed in were persecuted severely, not only in the Papal States, but in all of the Western European countries. Thus, the Holy See and its sovereign nation, the Papal States now reduced to the Vatican City, historically meets the described criteria of Daniel's vision. Obviously, as the Holy See is the religious authority of some 2/3 of Christendom, they would object to that relationship, because it says God will destroy them and give to those whom they persecuted the kingdom of God. But that is what the book of Daniel teaches. For the kings are not given this vision to know and understand it, nor are they taught the lesson of this vision. Daniel is a sole recipient, a worshiper of the God of heaven, not a worshiper of any government or of any religious entity aligned with the kingdoms of the world. And the Bible tells us the God of heaven has only ever aligned himself with one group of people, Israel. And we know that Israel ceased to be a nation of the world when conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. And it ceased to be a vassal state of other empires when it was destroyed by Rome in AD 70. And Israel today, though it exists as a nation, is really not accepted as an equal nation of the world. If the United Nations were to vote today to create Israel, as opposed to when they voted in 1947, Israel would never be a nation. The story of this vision concludes with a lesson about judgment in verses 26 to 28. The judgment shall sit, the kingdom's dominion and greatness under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is eternal. All dominions serving and obeying God. And to drive the point home, the angel concludes his explanation of the vision by telling Daniel, "Hitherto is the end of the matter." The lesson is quite simple. Everything going around in the world today will be brought to nothing by God. And then and only then will the activities of the fourth beast cease. And those activities are described in verse 23. The activities that will cease are the devouring of the whole earth, the treading down of the earth, and the breaking of the earth in pieces. And I think we can all agree what we have seen of governments, corporations, financial institutions, and the like. They have done just that to the world and brought us to the state we are now living in. Chapter 8 is the story of Daniel's second vision, where God shows a battle between a he-goat and a great horn, with a great horn, and a ram that had become very great. We're told in verse 20, the ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire. And in verse 21, the great horn of the he-goat is the first king of the Grecian Empire, Alexander the Great, which quickly defeated the Persian ram. And shortly afterwards, in less than 10 years, Alexander died. The great horn is broken off, and four horns replace it. And we know this from history. So history again matches the vision. But something unusual happens, for out of one of these horns there rises another horn, described in verses 9 to 12 as representing the fourth beast, for it takes away the daily sacrifice of the Jews, which is what the Roman Empire did in AD 70. Also, this last horn is said to be destroyed without hand, which is how Nebuchadnezzar's image is destroyed by a stone cut out of the mountain without hands. So this vision describes certain other events of the timeline of Nebuchadnezzar's image, strengthening Daniel's trust and belief in God. The lesson of the vision of the he-goat and the ram is this: I make you know what shall be the last end and the latter time of their kingdom, when transgressors are come to the full. A king of fierce countenance shall stand up. He shall stand against the prince of princes. He shall be broken without hand, the vision is true. The last end, also referred to as the time of the end, is when the transgressors have come to the fullness of their transgression against God and his earth. Essentially, they have brought the earth to its knees, so to speak. And then their king, speaking of a single king, shall be broken without hand. And we can turn to Ezekiel 38 and 39, Daniel's contemporary, and we would read of just that, of someone or something described as Gog, leading many nations who are destroyed by God. It is often referred to as the Battle of Armageddon. Obviously, no nation wants to accept this description of their governing. But the angel explaining the vision to Daniel states very much otherwise. The vision is true. Chapter 9 is the story of Daniel's prayer, wanting to know when Israel would be restored, when Jerusalem would again be the place of worship of the God in heaven. The answer to his prayer, especially verses 24 to 27, is perhaps the most remarkable prophecy in the Bible, a prophecy we commonly refer to as the 70 weeks prophecy, understood to mean that from the king of Persia's order to rebuild Jerusalem, assumed to be in the time of Nehemiah, whose record is part of the Bible, that 490 years later, Christ would appear and be crucified. The Bible also speaks of the people being in anticipation of Christ's appearing, giving credence to the prophecy's understanding among the Jewish people. 77s are determined upon your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in eternal righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, to anoint the most holy. After 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, after which the city of Jerusalem and the sanctuary will be destroyed. Messiah shall confirm the covenant, even until the consummation, that is, until the end of the kingdoms of men in the earth. And we know in AD 70, the city of Jerusalem and the sanctuary were destroyed. Christ, of course, is to become the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, the Messiah, the Son of God, who will destroy the image dreamt by Nebuchadnezzar, destroying the world's nations, their kings, their governments, and finally, bringing peace and tranquility to the earth. Finally, the story of chapters 10 to 12, which is a remarkable detail of events that would take place up to the time of Christ's crucifixion and some on into the future, even to our day and beyond. Though there is much to consider, we will focus upon two things. First, a time of trouble such as never was before there was a nation. That is a frightening thought. Trouble, the likes of which have never been known. We know financial crises. We're in one now. We know wars. We have two very well-known ones, spoken of every day. We know of starvation. We read of it every day. Genocide is being practiced every day. Disease, again, every day. And a host of other troubles we are fully aware of. But what this phrase states is these will pale in comparison to a trouble which lies ahead. There's no sense trying to imagine what it could mean. That would be an exercise in futility. But for those who will live during that time, they will know it to be something never before seen. And we do know it is still in the future. For the verse goes on to say, people written in the book shall be delivered. Many sleeping in the earth shall awake, some to eternal life, some to eternal contempt. So it is definitely future to our day and age. And that poses the question, how long until this happens? Again, we do not exactly know when. And that puts the onus upon us to order our lives accordingly, for there are only two outcomes. God will judge us for what we do with our life, and it will either be to eternal life or to eternal contempt. And that very much comes down to whether we believe the visions and prophecies God has given to Daniel. There is also the statement in verse 4, shut up the words, seal the scroll to the time of the end. Daniel must have been told more than is recorded in the book of Daniel. So we ask, is that sealed scroll found elsewhere in the Bible? Well, we do know that in Revelation chapter 5, there is a scene where the risen Christ opens a sealed scroll on which are written events that lead to the time of the end. And it has descriptions of nations and powers of the earth, remarkably similar to those used in Daniel chapters 7 and 8. So yes, it appears everything revealed to Daniel is presently known to us today, to be found in these two books of the Bible. And then there is the conclusion of the book of Daniel. None of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Our natural inclination is to reject what is true but unpleasant, and to embrace what is obviously false but comforting. Which is the difference between understanding and not understanding. The book of Daniel claims itself to be true. History confirms it to be true. But what it says is indeed unpleasant. And to some, it is totally unpalatable. Therefore, some prefer to embrace the notion is but a story of myths, or it only applies to the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, for that makes them feel comfortable. The question we face is, do we want to know, or do we simply want to be comfortable?